State of the United States and the Constitution.
Good afternoon, please be seated. We're here for argument in case number 22-14015, Michael Wayne Reynolds versus the Commissioner of the Alabama Department of Corrections. We have Mr. Campbell for Mr. Reynolds and Mr. Anderson for the Commissioner. Mr. Campbell, whenever you're ready.
Thank you and good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Patrick Campbell and I represent the petitioner, Michael Wayne Reynolds. The jury who convicted Mr. Reynolds to death did not hear two critical pieces of evidence: that there was another person who confessed to the crimes, and that the State Star witness, Marcy West, the only witness directly linking Mr. Reynolds to the crimes, had to deal with the state for leniency on her own criminal charges. I want to start with the Brady-Giglio violation, and I want to focus the court's attention here today on what the state has withheld from Mr. Reynolds throughout these proceedings. Mr. Reynolds has never had the full file on Ms. West. When the Alabama Court of Criminal, when the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals remanded the proceedings back to the Rule 32 trial court to give Mr. Reynolds an opportunity to prove his Brady-Giglio claim, the state did not turn over the full file of Ms. West. Rather, it removed files that Mr. Reynolds has never been able to see. Now, I want to refer, Your Honors, to...
Why do you believe that?
Because these records are reflected in Mr. Montgomery's time records.
But why does that... It seems to be an inferential leap. Now, whether it's a reasonable one or not is, I guess, the question that we have to talk about. But it seems like an inferential leap to say, I have other records which indicate documents that should be in the file, but they are not in the file, so that means that they're withholding it from us, versus there are other documents that are referred to that are not in the file because for one reason or another, they're not in the file of a case that is 10, 15, whatever many years old from there. Stuff gets lost. It never was in the file in the first place. In other words, they got a letter, they sent a letter, they never kept a copy, they put it in the trash can. Why do we make the assumption that from those missing documents that there must be withheld documents?
Well, Your Honor, the state has never explained why those documents aren't in there. The state has never given an explanation, although we pointed them to very specific documents. One document, the letter that was sent from ADA Reed to Mr. Montgomery on 5-1-2009, that's at A-1734, that he reviewed. His time record said he reviewed that letter. That was just a couple of weeks before Ms. West's sentencing hearing, where Mr. Reed strenuously argued and advocated for Ms. West's early release.
Well, they were ordered, and I've read the order, they were ordered to turn over any and all. There was no indication, as I understand, below, and by below I mean in the Rule 32 court, mm-hmm. There was no indication that there was any inference that anything had been withheld. There was no, I didn't get this document, so give me more. The ACCA found that there was a full file given over, and we have some deference with regard to that fact finding. In other words, we're required to presume it's correct until it's clearly and convincingly wrong. That's the position we're in right now. And you're telling me I have to find it clearly and convincingly wrong, that particular finding of fact, which is relevant to your discovery claim and some other stuff, based on an inference that stuff that you think should be in the file is not?
Well, Your Honor, there are materials that were clearly removed from the file. There was a post-it note on one of the docket sheets from Ms. West.
That's not the file, though. That's the court docket, right? And I understand that. There was a post-it note in the court docket.
It was removed.
I'm a little familiar with that because when I was a state trial court judge, we had literally the same typewritten, handwritten dockets and stuff like that. So that post-it note wasn't there, but that's not the state court file. I mean, that's not the prosecutor's file.
I submit to Your Honor that post-it note was on a document in the prosecution's file. And counsel at Rule 32 habeas proceeding noted that for the court, and also noted for the court in a supplemental petition, because the trial court only gave counsel 20 days for an opportunity to prove Mr. Reynolds' claim after the circuit court had remanded the case to give Mr. Reynolds an opportunity to prove his claim. The trial court gave 20 days. Mr. Reynolds made...
Sorry, counsel, yeah. This is at Appendix 1821. At the top of it says, Alabama Judicial Information System, Case Action Summary, Circuit Criminal. This is a court docket. This is not a prosecution file.
Well, I submit, Your Honor, that the file was from the court docket, but when the state's files were given over to counsel to inspect, that document was in there and the post-it was removed. So that is part of the evidence. That is part of the
reason. I know, but this came from, the post-it came from, and you even articulate this in your brief. This is not contested. You got this originally from pulling the court docket, and what you're saying is the copy that was in the state didn't have the post-it, but it was never on the post-it in the state's file. It was in the post-it that was in the court file. The whole point was the court stating to itself, don't schedule this because the prosecutor told me not to schedule this. That's a court file. I don't see how that proves, is by clear and convincing evidence, what you're talking about.
Okay. If you don't accept that, Your Honor.
Not a matter of me accepting it. I just stated the facts.
There's the letter, the clear reference to a letter between Reed and Montgomery that wasn't in the file. There are numerous communications that Montgomery and Ms. West and the state had throughout various different time periods before the guilty plea, Ms. West's guilty plea, before the sentencing period.
Those indicated they met. In other words, they talked.
They talked.
But how is that going to be reflected in a paper file?
Notes. Notes, Your Honor.
Those are reflect. I don't know what happened in this case, obviously, but there are times when meetings, decisions, offers, and the like are reflected in notes to the file by the attorney. Right, that's what you're saying.
Yes, and I posit that is a common practice that, and we're not talking about just a couple of random communications. We're
when
talking
the state,
about
when the state turned over, you say it was an incomplete file, but when the state turned that over during the Rule 32 proceedings on remand, what did the state represent it was giving you?
So the state made the file for inspection, available for inspection. At the state's office under the state supervision.
But did the state, whether it's correct or an incorrect or correct characterization, did the state tell you, as sometimes happens, here is the entire case file, go through it, see what you want and what you want to copy? Is that what, whether that's a correct characterization or not of what was actually there, is that what they represented? Like, here's the entire file, go through it? Or did they say nothing, or did they say something different?
Yeah, I wasn't there, Your Honor. I have to consult, and I'll get you the answer to that. But my understanding is they gave over a case file and said, you know, here it is. You can inspect it. But I'm not positive about the representation that they made.
But all right, let's talk about the Brady Giglio claim. And you've got two different things or arguments with regard to that claim, right? You've got the merits issue on both of the claims. And you've got the evidentiary hearing aspect of those claims. So you can start with whichever one you want, but I don't want you to run out of time without getting to the merits of the arguments you've got present here.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. And I did want to start with the discovery evidentiary hearing claim. And, you know, we just discussed the documents that we believe have been withheld from the file, and that they show that they would show relevant information just based on the context of when those communications happened that would further allow Mr. Reynolds to develop his claim. And I just want to just be clear about why we believe this is a problem. The evidence that Mr. Reynolds does have showing an understanding between Ms. West and the state for leniency, he either got lucky finding it or he had to fight tooth and nail to get it. And the part that he got lucky finding were the post-it notes that we talked about before, where his trial counsel had made a copy of the docket sheet with the post-it notes on it that clearly said to put Ms. West's criminal charges, all of her criminal charges, off indefinitely while she cooperated against Mr. Reynolds. And the memorandum, the one he had to fight tooth and nail to get.
But you just added the while she was cooperating, right?
Yes.
That's not what the post-it note says.
No. Your Honor, the post-it note is not. The post-it note says from the DA, Harp, to the West trial judge at the time, put off these cases indefinitely, and it included both the drug cases and the hindering the prosecution case, which is what she was charged under in the Martin's murder case.
Okay, Mr. Campbell here, let me tell you, I'm really afraid you're going to be running out of time on some of this stuff, so let me tell you where I sort of see things,
okay,
and then you can direct me one way or another. If I were sitting as the trial judge in this case, or even an appellate judge on the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals, this would cause me great concern. there's a lot of circumstantial evidence, and people who have been around doing criminal work for a long time see patterns, and this is the sort of pattern that sometimes looks like there was a deal in place or a deal to be had. Having said all of that, you've got findings by the Alabama courts based on the affidavits of the defense lawyer, the prosecutor, and Ms. West herself that there was no deal before Mr. Reynolds' trial. And you've got not only the clear error standard to deal with, but you've got the AEDPA gloss on how we look at state court factual findings. So tell me how you overcome those.
So I'll tell you both, because they're related, I think, in terms of the substance. But first, we have the failure to grant an evidentiary hearing. And
that one is, that's a district court.
Yes.
That's a district court issue, right? It doesn't, they overlap, I think, but it's not necessarily dictated by the state court's findings of fact.
That's correct.
Right. You can have a case where there are state court findings of fact, and you may have room for an evidentiary hearing under AEDPA. So I get that. Put that one off to the side. Let's talk about the Brady-Giglio claims on the merits, because if those findings stand under AEDPA's deferential standard, you lose on both of those claims, right? Because then there's no deal to have been reported to you or given to you, and her testimony at trial about no deal was not false and didn't need to be corrected, right?
Well, Your Honor, I think the standard is slightly different for evidentiary hearings under the Pope case.
I know. I'm trying to compartmentalize those two. If you want to start evidentiary hearing, start evidentiary hearing.
I gather what you want to hear, Your Honor.
No, I don't want to hear anything. But I don't think the two are exactly the same. As you said, they have different legal standards. So there's a standard for analyzing the denial of an evidentiary hearing, and there's a standard for analyzing the merits decisions of the Alabama courts on your Brady and Giglio claims. You can start with whichever one you want, but I think they're different.
Okay. You're right, Your Honor, when you pointed out that the Rule 32 Circuit Court was concerned. That's why they remanded the case. They found that Mr. Reynolds pled a Brady claim. They remanded for an opportunity for Mr. Reynolds to prove that claim. They didn't give him that opportunity, though he made various requests for discovery and evidentiary hearing. They never got it. I will submit, Your Honor, that that lack of diligence, plus what I'm about to tell you about the record evidence of the Brady claim, entitles Mr. Reynolds to an evidentiary hearing, at least in this case. And what he had before the circuit court at the end of the day was substantial proof of a deal.
Doesn't Section 22E2, though, require, and there's a bunch of different levels to this evidentiary hearing claim, but at least 2254E2 seems to require evidence of factual innocence, does it not?
I don't think so, Your Honor. It requires diligence, that there couldn't be any reason on the part of the defendant. And also requires the defendant to show that the allegations pled, if true, would entitle him to relief. Those are the two components of the evidentiary hearing standard. We feel that the process he wasn't given, though he requested every time, meets the first component. And the second component, I would posit to Your Honors that the Rule 32 court's determination already that he pled a meritorious Brady claim, even before it went back up, would satisfy that standard.
Isn't the claim, I'm just reading from E2, if the applicant has failed to develop the factual basis of a claim in state court in the state court proceedings, the court shall not hold an evidentiary hearing on the claim unless the applicant shows that, the facts underlying the claim would be sufficient to establish by clear and convincing evidence that but for constitutional error, in other words, you have to show that constitutional error, no reasonable fact finder would have found the applicant guilty of the underlying offense. You have to show that, don't you?
I think, though, Your Honor, the way
that... Or that a reasonable fact finder would...
The way the Pope versus Secretary of Department of Corrections, it's citing in our brief 680 F3rd 1271, interpreted that provision to say that there's two components here, that the petitioner has to demonstrate the facts underlying his Brady-Giglio claim, personalizing to us, would be sufficient to entitle him to relief. That's the first component. The second component is the failure to establish those facts in earlier stage was not due to a lack of diligence. So that's how the Second Circuit, the 11th Circuit, have interpreted E2 is really the diligence prong because of the way they constructed a statute.
And right, the way you read it is that you have not failed to develop the facts because you kept asking and asking and asking, and you didn't get.
Right.
So you're not at fault under E2, and therefore the actual innocence kicker doesn't apply to you. That's your reading of that provision.
That's our reading of Pope. That's how we see that case. And so, correct. The amount of times that he requested an evidentiary hearing below and wasn't given one, and the district court didn't give him an evidentiary hearing or discovery either, I think satisfies the diligence prong. Now, when you're getting into the merits, Your Honors, you know, again, I think the Rule 32 Circuit Court's finding that there was a notorious Brady claim could be enough. But even
that's on the pleading side, right?
Yes.
If you can prove these facts, you've got a meritorious Brady claim. But now you have factual findings crediting the affidavits of the prosecutor, the defense lawyer, and Ms. West herself. So how do you deal with those?
We think those are unreasonable application of facts to the case. With two respects. Number one, those affidavits were never tested, okay? There was never any opportunity for cross-examination. They fly in the face of the overwhelming record evidence that was presented at the Rule 32 court. For that reason, we think that the Rule 32 court made an unreasonable application of the facts. That is part of the standard.
But the Alabama rules allow for evidentiary submissions for which a court can make findings of fact, does it not?
They allow for that, correct.
Right. Isn't that what happened here?
Well, our position is it was unreasonable for them to not grant Mr. Reynolds an evidentiary hearing in light of the overwhelming record evidence that we put in at Rule 32 and to only defer to those affidavits that were never tested on cross-examination, that were self-serving, that were inconsistent internally.
I know, but the Alabama rules allow for findings of fact to be made based on competing evidence, based on evidentiary submissions. In fact, the remand instruction on the first appeal from the ACCA specifically said you can do it one way or you can do it another way, and they picked one of the ways.
Yes, we're not saying that the circuit court required the trial court to hold an evidentiary hearing. That's not our argument. Our position is that the trial courts and the circuit court's adoption of that order to rely on those affidavits in the face of all the other evidence. You had Ms. West facing 70 years in prison before Mr. Reynolds' trial, which gave her a clear incentive to cooperate. You had her cooperating right away, spending significant time with the agents and the prosecutors in the first couple of days after the murders, where she started the pattern of inculpating herself, seemingly without fear of putting herself in further jeopardy of her drug charges or of her hindering the prosecution.
How can we say that it's either clear and convincing wrong or no fair-minded jurist can reach that fact, where there's the three affidavits from all the relevant parties saying that there was no deal at the time, and the court did an in-camera review of the file itself, the one that you say that you didn't get a chance to look at. It looked at all those documents in there, and it looked at the plea colloquy from the blind plea that was eventually entered into. Based on all of that, why is it not reasonable, let alone whether it's right or not, we can talk about, but whether it's reasonable for a fair-minded jurist to make that call?
On that file that you're speaking about, Your Honor, that's Mr. Reynolds' prosecution file. The documents were withheld from that file as well. Mr. Reynolds' trial court ordered the production of that file, and the state was able to take documents out of that file on work product grounds.
I'm talking about the in-camera review that was done by this judge. Yep. So this judge saw all the documents, including the privileged ones, and the affidavits, and the blind plea colloquy. And based on all of that evidence, made a call. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't contrary evidence or contrary inferences. It just means that where there's two choices, it's not unreasonable to pick one over the other.
In our position, our view, Your Honor, is that it was unreasonable because there was a blind. The reasoning was that there was a blind plea, but you had an agreement, a deal, a memorandum that was drafted by West lawyer.
But counsel, that memorandum states that there's an agreement with the DA.
Yes.
It doesn't indicate time frames. You infer that agreement existed at the time of the original trial, but it's just as reasonable, even putting aside counsel's own explanation for it, even saying that that's a lie. It still is reasonable to say that the agreement was the agreement they made on the spot when the memo was drafted, not 3 or 4 years before, right?
That's the case, Your Honor. It still casts into doubt the trial court's reason. One of the bases that there was a blind plea. If there was a blind plea, there'd be no sorts of discussions about an agreement between the state and West on any deal. If it's a blind plea, then there's no agreement. The court is going to make a decision. But then you had that memorandum that reflected the conversation that there was an understanding.
What that calls into question is whether there was an agreement at the time of the plea. That doesn't indicate the question you need to answer and to find to be clearly erroneous from the state court, and that is that there was a deal at the time of the trial or before sentence, before he was actually sentenced?
Well, Your Honor, we believe that the evidence puts that memorandum into context, which was the evidence that was going through, West's pattern, her lawyer's conduct during the proceeding, where you know, he did not prepare her for her examination at trial, didn't attend the examination at trial. He didn't prepare a mitigating case. You know, his conduct reflects that she had an agreement in place. And then you have the state's own conduct.
It reflects a lack of work. That's certainly what it reflects. Given that we're here on an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, is it unreasonable that counsel was ineffective in representing Ms. West?
Your Honor, just from looking at that record, either he was unethical.
Let me ask you this. How many ineffective assistance of counsel subclaims did you file against the trial counsel for
several,
Mr. Reynolds here?
Several.
20, 30?
Several.
Right. So it's not unreasonable that a counsel didn't do something because counsel's not effective. But you take from that and infer from that that it must mean that he had a deal. I'm having trouble understanding that.
That's just one piece of evidence, Your Honor. The critical piece of evidence, we believe, is the state's conduct, where the state advocated for Ms. West at her sentencing hearing. And that's the reason why this claim had ripened and they brought the Rule 32 claim on it, where ADA Reed got up there, even though there was supposed to be a blind plea, and strenuously argued for Ms. West to get a year, up to a year on a murder, drug charges and hindering prosecution charges that would have gotten her 7 years in jail. And then they went back to the court and recommended her release as to 6 months. When you put all that together, then not only does it show that Mr. Reynolds has a meritorious Brady claim, but it shows that he is at least entitled to an evidentiary hearing, because he tried to get one all through the process, the state courts and district court, and with the evidence that was produced already, he has at least as a claim that, if true, entitles him to relief. He's never gotten an evidentiary hearing claim. There's never been an explanation of the lack of records, the lack of notes and documents in the state's file that we believe should be there. The state doesn't have anything to hide. If the state doesn't think there's a deal in place, or there's no records in Ms. West's file that show a deal, what's the harm in giving Mr. Reynolds a day in court and finally give him an evidentiary hearing?
Like I said, Mr. Campbell, I think Mr. Reynolds probably got the raw end of the stick in the Alabama courts, because given the in my personal opinion, the evidence that was presented was circumstantial, no doubt, but pretty strong circumstantial evidence that there was something going on. But you've got to deal with the findings of the Alabama courts on that issue afterwards. So let me ask you, if you can, in the time you have left, and can you give him another couple of minutes, please? Can you address the claim related to Mr. Martin's confession?
Thank you, Your
Honor.
And
particularly this. In a normal case, one would think that the failure to put on a third party's confession to a murder, like, is per se ineffective assistance of counsel on the performance side. But in this case, you've got this wrinkle, and I'd like you to talk about it, please. The wrinkle is that confession would have run counter to Mr. Reynolds' own narrative in this respect. Mr. Reynolds admitted that he went into the house with Ms. West, although it was Ms. West who had done something that she didn't really reveal in detail to him, and then he tried to help her out by doing what he said he did. But that third-party confession would have run counter to that narrative, even if you believe Mr. Reynolds completely. So how does that play into the ineffectiveness claim?
Your Honor, you're correct in that there is that deviation between the confession and Mr. Reynolds' testimony. However, we still think the confession, the lack of getting the confession before the jury, prejudices Mr. Reynolds. For one, it contradicts Marcy West's testimony. Marcy West was the direct evidence between the crimes and Mr. Reynolds. The state, at most, had select forensic evidence that just showed he was there at some point, you know, and like he testified after the crime. Even though Mr. Martin's confession doesn't totally match up with Mr. Reynolds' testimony, it directly contradicts that Ms. West's testimony. Had the jury heard that Martin confessed,
wouldn't have demolished your client's credibility and the entire defense if they had put that in?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. First of all, in the time...
The entire defense was that your client went in afterwards to burn down the house to cover for Ms. Weston himself for having gone in to clean up after her. That's the theory. The confession is completely contrary to that. Well, completely.
Well, let me start by saying this. The confession was disallowed before Mr. Reynolds took the stand. Okay, so there could have been a decision made not to have Mr. Reynolds take the stand. That's the timing of it. But also, again, there are contradictions. But
it's actually worse than Judge Jordan described, at least to me, because the confession not only says the complete opposite of what your client testified to, it actually implicates your client as having been there at the time of the murders.
Well, I don't think it implicates. Chad Martin never admitted that Mr. Reynolds was there.
If the jury heard this confession that said, Michael, so who else was there? Michael was there. Who's Michael? Michael Reynolds? Damn. Michael Reynolds was there? No, I'm clamming up. I want my lawyer. I don't want to talk anymore. That is damning to your client. How can an attorney possibly admit that into evidence when your client's saying that he didn't do it, wasn't there until after it's done?
Well, he did determine it was reasonable. He did determine that was strategy because the attorney did try to get it in. That statement was made after the police were berating Mr. Martin and they didn't believe him. We know the circumstances, you know, why they
that would have undermined your whole defense, the third party confession, if you said they beat it out of him.
No, that part they did. They refused to believe when he was confessing. And it's not Mr. Reynolds' burden to prove his theory.
You're right, but the problem is, at this point, at the prejudice side, I'm not talking about the deficiency side, we have to see if it was reasonable for the state appellate court, to have weighed the aggravating and mitigating circumstances. And here, and also the how this would have affected the verdict. And we have to weigh the good with the bad. And there just seems to be a lot of bad here that it would be reasonable for an attorney or reasonable to conclude that this didn't affect the verdict.
I think what you have, Your Honor, is the only evidence of someone saying they committed the crime. Chad Martin said he committed the crime. Chad Martin said two other people committed the crime with him. Mr. Reynolds and I committed the crime. Ms. West pointed at Reynolds. This evidence, had it been before the jury, would have created at least a reasonable doubt for them to believe Ms. West's side of the story. And that's why we think it was prejudice.
All right, Mr. Campbell, thank you very much. You've saved all of your time for rebuttal. Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Richard Anderson for the state of Alabama, appellee in this matter. This was a highly aggravated case. In the early morning hours of May 25th, 2003, Wayne Reynolds, in the company of Ms. West, traveled to the Martin family home. In his words, it was to get some money. When he arrived there, he took a knife into the house and he exterminated the Martin family. In the kitchen, he found Mr. Martin. He stabbed him 11 times, killing him. Then he went to a bedroom where he first found Melinda Martin. In a struggle, his glasses were broken, leaving part of his glasses on the bed. And in the course of that, he stabbed Mrs. Martin 24 times, before moving on to 8-year-old Savannah Martin. Now, Savannah Martin was a little thing. At her autopsy, she only weighed 73 pounds. It only took 5 stab wounds to kill her. Afterwards, Mr. Reynolds tried to cover up his guilt by dousing the scene with gasoline. Mr. Reynolds' guilt is not in legitimate question. There is...
You say that, and maybe you're right with regards to the deferential standards we have to apply. But when you have a third-party confession, that puts guilt in play. Maybe not to the point that he needs it to succeed in a habeas petition, but this is not one of those cases where you're just talking about legal sufficiency. There's a little more here. It may not get him to where he needs to go, but you've got a third-party confession, and that makes this case different, at least some ways.
Your Honor, for the purposes of this proceeding here, we are under an AEDPA deferential standard. We're looking.
You
at
have that. The AEDPA standard doesn't. Okay. The AEDPA standard does not change the existence of that third party confession by Mr. Martin. Correct. That confession exists.
And Your Honor, I
would... No one can wish it away, write it away, explain it away, right?
I would dispute you on one point, Your Honor. It is not a third-party confession. It is a police report.
Come on, Mr. Anderson.
A third-party confession.
And a policeman is going to make that up in a report and just make up that somebody confessed to the horrible triple murder that you just described. Some police officer in Alabama is going to be bad enough at his job and evil enough at his job that he's going to write a report implicating an innocent third party. That's the state's position?
Your Honor, that report is full of self-contradictory material and inaccuracies.
So are a lot of confessions.
Some of them are very significant factual inaccuracies, Your Honor. One of which is this. Perhaps the most evocative and powerful part of that purported confession is the purported statement by Mr. Martin Chad that when he was stabbing Savannah, she was just looking at me with those big brown eyes. A very powerful statement, Your Honor. But there's a problem. I've read Savannah Martin's autopsy report, as I'm sure that the jury did. Savannah Martin's eyes were blue.
Counsel, this is not where you need to be arguing, in my view. I will tell you that the part that I'm troubled by, and I can't speak for anyone else, and it isn't at the guilt phase, but it is at the residual doubt penalty side of it. Because it would seem to me that I understand the strategic reason, and I understand prejudice-wise, given all the testimony that was there, that how this may not have affected the ultimate verdict of guilt. But why would you not, how would this not have affected the residual doubt argument such that at least, were we in a 10-2 situation during this trial?
I think it was a unanimous verdict, actually.
I know, but it was Alabama law 10-2.
Yes, I believe
so
it was.
So that three jurors would not have been persuaded.
Well, Your Honor, again, it's what you've pointed out earlier, the problem with that Chad Martin statement, I'll go ahead and call it that, is that it is so self-contradictory and it is so critically contradictory with Mr. Reynolds' theory of the case. And it is so in some very important ways, because one of those that one of Mr. Reynolds' points of his strategy was saying, well, I was there, but only to pour gasoline over the scene.
Maybe I'm incorrect, but my understanding is that they didn't learn about it until after Mr. Reynolds made the decision to testify.
Chad Martin.
Did they know about the Chad?
I believe that counsel was aware of that for some time. The Chad, I'm not aware of any allegation that the Chad Martin statement was suppressed or anything like that. I think everyone knew about it.
No, I think you're right. I mean, that's why he tried to get it in a couple of ways. It didn't work. And then he said, I'm not going to try any further ways to get the officer here.
And as Judge Luck was pointing out, one of the problems, again, with that statement is that it put Mr. Reynolds there when the crime was occurring. And
I know, but for residual doubt, unlike a trial, there doesn't need to be sort of perfectness. In other words, the whole concept of residual doubt is if you have any doubt in your mind about how this thing came, you should err on the side of life as opposed to death.
And residual doubt, Your Honor, under Alabama law, is not a mitigating circumstance.
Yeah, but that is, I have to tell you, that is not something that we would defer to. I mean, there is federal case after federal case, including our own. I think your opposing counsel does a good job in their brief of pointing out all the times that we've said sometimes residual doubt's all you got. Even the federal district court didn't rely on that fact because it's just not right as a matter of federal law. So that may be the rule in Alabama, and that's fine, and their court can do whatever it wants. But I don't think that's something that we would defer to ADEPA-wise because it's not a conclusion with which that would impact the question that we have. And so with this in there, why is it not prejudicial that three jurors would not have been persuaded that someone else confessed to the crime and to do the most horrible thing that you've just described at the start of your oral argument?
Your Honor, one, again, that statement just doesn't create any legitimate doubt. Mr. Reynolds admits to having poured gasoline on the bodies or on the scene and the victims. And in the autopsy reports, all of the victims had chemical burns to their bodies. The testimony from the pathologist was that they all didn't die instantaneously.
I know, but Chad said that he smelled the gasoline. I mean, he essentially indicated that I am still burdened with the smell of gasoline from having murdered someone I consider to be my brother, his wife, and
Your Honor, the jury did hear that Chad Martin said, "I can smell the gasoline on my hands." The jury heard that Chad Martin said that Savannah screamed.
Is that then the response? In other words, that Lieutenant Gray's testimony allowed them to make the residual doubt argument if they wished to make that? In other words, the factual record was there for which they could have made the residual doubt argument.
The testimony was in and was not objected to, Your Honor, so certainly counsel could have if they'd chosen to.
But you fought to exclude the substantive testimony. It's very hard for you to get up here now and say the jury had it. You did not have to object to the testimony of the witness about the statement that Mr. Martin purportedly gave, but you objected, and the objection was sustained.
And Your Honor, we're looking here at the prejudice question and whether that jury heard that information, and they did. So whether the state objected at the time to the entire statement coming in.
Did it hear that Mr. Martin had confessed to the murders?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Did the jury hear that Mr. Martin had confessed to the murders? The answer is a resounding no. Because smelling the gasoline,
yes, Your Honor,
could mean that he was there as an accessory or that he was there to rob and steal but didn't commit the murder. And his statement, confession, whatever you call it, saying maybe, as Judge Luck said, that it implicates Mr. Reynolds in being there, doesn't mean that Mr. Reynolds was the person who committed the murders personally either. So there's a way of understanding his statement to help Mr. Reynolds.
At the end of the day, Your Honor, this court would simply have to decide whether no reasonable jurist could defer to the judgment of the Alabama courts. Because the Alabama courts considered all of this and reached a conclusion, and the plain fact of the matter is that this statement, such as it is, wouldn't have changed the picture in a powerful way.
Can we talk about what did come in? I read Lieutenant Gary's testimony, so I want to, Judge Jordan asked about that, I want to sort of see what actually did and what didn't come in. So as I understand it, and I'm looking at docket entry 18-18, starting at about page 53. It may be at different places in the docket entries, but that's the one that I'm looking at. That Lieutenant Gary said that that Chad told her that that told Lieutenant Gary where Savannah was in the house and where Savannah was. That was at the murder scene. In other words, Chad just shows up on his own and tells Lieutenant Gary where Savannah is in the house without having been in the house, or supposedly not having been in the house, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's how he came to the attention of the police and why he was taken in and questioned.
He actually knew where the father and the mother were as well. Right?
Yes, Your Honor, but it's looking at that testimony, it's actually not clear where he was right about it, because Lieutenant Gary said that Chad said that Savannah was in the closet, but Savannah was found on the bed with the bedclothes, which had Mr. Reynolds' broken piece of prescription eyeglasses on it.
Speaking of which, he told Lieutenant Gary, quote, "And then he was talking about his sunglasses, that he lost his sunglasses, a pair of sunglasses."
Right.
Right?
But there is absolutely no question in this case that the prescription sunglasses were Mr. Reynolds.
And that led Lieutenant Gary to then say, to tell the sergeant in charge that she was suspicious, and later they determined he was actually a suspect. Chad, right?
That's correct, Your. That's the point at which he was taken in.
Right. And so when he's taken in, he has the statement that's there, and then he actually sits down with Lieutenant Gary again. And he tells Lieutenant Gary, without any prompting by her, "You know, this may seem like or sound crazy, but it's as if I'm seeing through Chuck's eyes." He says, Chad said he could smell the gas on his hands and he didn't know where the cuts came from, that he could not hurt Savannah, but a phone call that he made was going to probably make him look bad, and that he could hear Savannah screaming, "Don't hurt me," something to that effect, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
That all came in, didn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Jury heard all that.
I believe the little bit more about that phone call in which he said to either his uncle or his brother was Mr. Martin, "You should change your message. You sound dead." So yes, Your Honor, all of that came in.
So how does that weigh into the prejudice analysis? So having gone through all that, so now whether at residual doubt or whether at the guilt stage, how does that play into whether the exclusion of the piece of paper or the authentication of that piece of paper, there's a fair-minded jurist would conclude that it was no reasonable probability of a different result?
Yes, the court would have to look at what the jury heard and what it didn't hear. And the very minimal additional amount, which is, as Judge Jordan does point out, a statement that he stabbed Savannah is what the jury didn't hear. There was the report doesn't actually say that he stabbed anyone else other than Savannah. But as I've noted, that report, if the jury looks at it, they're going to see this statement. She was looking at me with her big brown eyes when I did it. And they would have seen, and I'm sure the state would have pointed out if that come in, that she had blue eyes. And that Chad Martin certainly knew that, being either her uncle or her cousin. So there were a lot of problems and a lot of reason why a jury would not have given that statement very much weight. And
can we slide over to the first issue that Mr. Campbell started on? Can you, when the state was ordered to provide records to Mr. Reynolds' counsel on remand to the Rule 32 court, what does the record show that the state did?
Yeah, well, first I want to back up just a tiny bit, Your Honor, to look at what the trial or the Rule 32 trial court ordered. And what the court ordered was production of the entire file. The order reads, essentially, the district attorney is to produce to the petitioner the entire file for inspection under the supervision of the district attorney.
Any and all?
Yes, Your Honor. That is the order. It doesn't contain an exception. And I am not aware of any evidence in the record to suggest that the state did anything less than that.
Did the state withhold any privileged documents or work product or anything like that?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Mr. Campbell says yes.
And, well,
If the state turned everything over, why did the judge have to review everything in camera?
Well, the judge had already reviewed everything in camera prior to Rule 32 because there were a lot of Brady issues at the time of trial. And the judge, before trial, entered an order to the district attorney to produce his entire file regarding Ms. West and Mr. Reynolds to the court for inspection. The court reviewed the entire prosecution file, everything.
Before trial.
Before trial, looking for any sort of exculpatory evidence and found none. And it's the same judge who heard the Rule 32, and in his order denying relief, that was one of the factors he looked at. I mean, this is the judge who heard Ms. West's testimony. He had had the advantage of looking at everything prior to this being an issue, prior to this particular issue coming before him. So that's why that was so important. But, Judge Luck correctly points out this post-it note issue does not demonstrate anything was being withheld.
Can you answer Judge Jordan's question, though, which is, yes, I understood it. Please, and he can correct me if I'm wrong. I am often wrong, and he often does. If documents were withheld, in other words, if there was privileged documents that were withheld, in other words, there was not compliance with any and all, how does that impact the issue of whether there should be an evidentiary hearing or whether there should be additional discovery?
It wouldn't, Your Honor.
I think that's your, is that the question?
It wouldn't, Your Honor, because this court, federal courts, are looking at issues like this based on the record that was before the trial court, before the state court. And in this case, we do have an evidentiary record. The state courts did have an evidentiary basis for making the findings they did. And we look at what the evidence was that there was affirmatively no deal. And that was the testimony from Ms. West, both at trial and in her affidavit. There was the affidavit testimony of Ms. West's attorney. And I would like to point out in that affidavit, Mr. Montgomery, He did explain the supposed document that referenced a deal, and all it was, to the extent that...
The good cause finding from the federal district court is based on the concept that there was any and all documents turned over. That's a large part of why it denied relief here under Rule 6 of the Section 2254 rules. And so if the record supports your opposing counsel's position that at least some documents were withheld because of privilege or whatever, does that call into question the good cause finding of the federal district court?
No, Your Honor, because there's nothing to suggest that things were withheld, much less that things of Brady materiality were withheld. Excuse me. I would like to note also that...
So there's not a single memorandum or anything in the file from the prosecutor about why Ms. West was getting the recommended sentence she got?
Here's another interesting point about that, Judge Jordan.
Yes, sir. First,
there,
yes or no.
There was no recommendation of a sentence.
First, yes or no.
There is no record that I'm aware of about why she was getting, why she got ended up getting favorable treatment.
Doesn't that sound really strange to you?
Not at all, Your Honor.
In a case where she was the state star witness. Hold on.
Yes, sir.
The case was put off for so long, and then she gets this sweetheart deal on a blind plea. That stinks to high heaven.
Not at all, Your Honor. I understand you're referencing points that opposing counsel has made.
I'm not. Those are undeniable points. Let's start.
Did she get a sweetheart deal?
No, Your Honor, I would not characterize it as such.
You're kidding me, right?
I would say
What did she do on the drug side, Mr. Anderson?
Ms. West received favorable treatment.
What did she do on the drug side? What did she do as a person that got her in trouble with drugs? Tell me.
She got into trouble with drugs because she was associated with...
What did she do?
What was she charged with? It's very simple.
What did she do?
She was charged with several drug offenses, possession of paraphernalia, distribution, and something else, I believe.
If that's all you had, I could see this not being a sweetheart deal. But then she does what she says she did with Mr. Reynolds.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's undeniable that she gets this deal, right?
Your Honor, she did not get a deal. I do have to call into question that characterization because a deal implies that there was a deal
Wouldn't she have been charged with being an accessory?
I do not know the answer to that. I know she was charged with hindering the prosecution for the destruction of evidence. And I would like to note that at that sentencing hearing for Ms. West, one, the prosecution recommended nothing in the way of sentencing. And in fact, what the prosecution did...
Didn't the judge say something about what he had discussed before with the parties?
The judge said that there was discussion of whether she would serve 6 months or 12 months
That's still 12 months. Mr. Anderson, you're not looking at reality. You may win this case on AEDPA deference, but I cannot believe your answers to some of these questions. They're just factual questions. Her case gets put off until well after Mr. Reynolds' trial. She testifies as the state star witness. She gets less than a year in custody. There's a statement in the defense lawyer's file about an agreement having been reached. When that agreement was reached is another question, right? That's all undeniable so far. Have I missed anything?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And then she gets less than a year in prison on a supposed blind plea. And you're telling me the prosecutor didn't say anything on her behalf at the hearing?
She said nothing on her behalf at the hearing, Your Honor.
The prosecutor just stayed mute.
No, sir. What the prosecutor said
is what?
He didn't recommend a sentence. What he said was, he told the judge, I'm going to tell you, Your Honor, the good and the bad about Marcy West. And that's exactly what he did. He told the judge both that she provided critical information to the prosecution and also that she destroyed critical evidence.
And you think that a prosecutor worth his or her salt would not have at least told a defense lawyer, listen, I'm not making any promises, but if your client testified truthfully, I'll let that be known to the trial judge and let the trial judge exercise his or her discretion.
I'm not telling you that, Your Honor. The evidence is telling you that because all of the evidence in this case is absolutely clear that there was no deal.
You say that so confidently, I don't see how you can do that. Like I said, you may win this case based on standards of review, but...
Your Honor, it is
things like this do not generally happen in a capital case.
Your Honor,
they just do not.
It's axiomatic that defendants who have valuable information to the state may hope that they will receive favorable treatment if they're helpful, if they cooperate. It is also true that if someone
why wasn't her case set immediately for plea and sentencing then?
If Ms. West's attorney had done that, he would have been committing malpractice because if her case had been disposed of early, she would have lost any hope There's the hope, Your Honor.
But even as an AUSA, you could have a witness who's a defendant who received a sentence and then understood that they would get potentially a reduction in sentence afterwards for cooperation. So it's very unusual to me to think that you're going to have a star witness who has no one. I mean, you're going to have a debriefing with this defendant, with this star witness, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I don't imagine any defense counsel worth their salt is going to allow for a debriefing without any kind of understanding of what's happening.
Your Honor, and you've made a very good point there when you reference what an AUSA could do in this sort of situation, allow a case to be disposed of with the understanding we'll revisit sentencing or motion for a new sentencing, something based on cooperation. But that's only if you have a deal. If you don't have a deal, then everyone loses their influence at the moment the case is disposed of.
Do you think the prosecutor knew her testimony before he put her on the stand?
She had come to the police to tell them what.
Do you think the prosecutor knew her testimony before he put her on the stand?
I don't know, Your Honor. I assume that he assumed that she would testify based on.
I know you don't know because you weren't there and I wasn't there. Do you think the prosecutor knew her testimony before he put her on the stand?
I think the prosecutor expected that she would testify honestly based on her statements to the police and to the district attorney earlier when she first came to.
And you don't think the defense lawyer, if you think he was doing his job, would have requested some sort of protection against use of her statements against her?
Immunity.
Later? She comes in and testifies to what she says she did with Mr. Reynolds. If you don't have any sort of agreement with the state can say, you know what, your charge is just going up because you just admitted to X, Y, and Z, and we didn't know about X, Y, and Z before, so now you've got higher charges to deal with. No defense lawyer would have done that and let her go in blind like that.
And in that hypothetical, Your Honor, a prosecutor's office who, you know, took advantage of people who provided helpful information like that would soon find that the well was drying up, that no one wanted to cooperate. So I think that everyone had every motivation to not dispose of those charges.
Well, you're looking at this through rose-tinted glasses, Mr. Anderson. So, again, that doesn't affect the ultimate disposition of the case, but I think you're just ignoring reality to understand how criminal cases play out, specifically capital cases, and the way that witnesses are treated when they're testifying. There are too many flags that go up in this case to
Your
say
Honor,
that there was no deal, no agreement, no understanding. Do you think she expected to get some benefit if she testified truthfully?
I am certain that she hoped to benefit from
was
testifying
she asked,
truthfully.
Was she asked at trial whether she expected something?
She was not asked. She was asked whether she faced charges, and she said that she did. I take that back. She was asked if there was a deal at the time of trial, and she testified that she did not have one. But what she expected, I don't think the question was asked quite that way.
Where do we look in the record, Mr. Anderson, to find out whether or not there were any qualifiers put on the state's production of its files to Mr. Reynolds during the Rule 32 proceedings, or whether they were turned over fully as the Rule 32 court ordered?
As I stand here, Your Honor, I don't have a record site to point you to. Okay.
Do you think there's somewhere to find that, though, or do you think the record is just silent on that?
I am not certain of the answer to that, Your Honor. So
can I point one thing out briefly? So your opposing counsel filed a very long brief. In fact, they asked for additional words, which is not something we always grant, but was appropriate here, and we granted it here. Your brief is 20 pages. It's the shortest that I've ever seen on a first-time habeas.
Yes, Your Honor.
Ever. In any court that I've ever served on. Some of these things maybe could have been addressed if it was longer than 20 pages. In other words, the question that Judge Jordan is asking you was brought up in the brief of your opposing counsel. He said exactly that privileged documents were withheld, and I didn't get any and all. So that seems like something that could have been addressed with the 30 or 40 more pages you had to work with here.
Perhaps so, Your Honor. But the factual pattern that was before the state courts is so very clear. That's what the state chose to focus on. That's what I chose to focus on, is what the evidence actually was before the state court, contrasting it with the evidence that Mr. Reynolds put forward, what he called an expansive evidentiary basis for a deal existing, was nothing more than some inferences based on timing and a single document that referenced an agreement that happened, if you know, to the extent it was an agreement, it happened a year after trial. And that's it.
I want to go back to something that Judge Jordan asked you about. He asked you whether this was a sweetheart deal or not, or something to that effect.
Yes, sir.
What did it was ADA Reed is the assistant district attorney, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
What did he have to say about this plea agreement in terms of others that are either consistent or not consistent like that for people who've been charged with similar crimes as Miss
West? The judge, I don't know that Mr. Reed said much about it, but Judge Milliken, who actually heard this case in post-conviction, he talked about the differences, the fact that one of the other witnesses was, who was also charged with hindering prosecution, was sentenced by a different judge. And he said that's a practice that's no longer done in that circuit.
Well, I'm looking at, this is Appendix 1873, and it's paragraph 8 of the Reed affidavit. Quote, the sentences to the maximum terms possible on her charges are actually severe compared to other defendants charged with similar offenses, given the defendant's personal circumstances. Ms. West had no prior felony conviction, no subsequent encounters with the law, and goes on to explain. Is that not what the record suggests?
That's correct, Your Honor. And part of what D.A. Reed explained at the sentencing hearing, and part of his telling the good and the bad to the court, was that the drug charges, Ms. West had no prior charges at all. She had no criminal history. And the drug charges arose out of her association with Mr. Reynolds. In fact, on the day of the murder, Mr. Reynolds was arrested on drug charges. So the prosecutor took into account the fact that her criminal problems really arose entirely out of her association and her relationship with Mr. Reynolds.
What about Attorney Montgomery? Did he comment at all about the nature of this particular deal, whether it was good or not good or consistent with how other defendants are?
Well, again, I'm sorry to keep saying this, but it wasn't a deal. The sentence she actually received based on the value of her testimony, I think, was appropriate.
So I'm looking at...
Right, but if you say value of the... You say there was no deal or agreement even after the fact?
There was an agreement. So what the record indicates is that in January, around the time of the plea, Mr. Montgomery told the prosecution, I'm going to ask. The agreement is I'm going to be allowed to ask the judge for a kind of a drug treatment program and to have a 6-month sentence rather than a 12-month sentence upon successful completion of that program. That's what Mr. Montgomery says the deal was.
But deal means there's willing parties on both sides. So the prosecutor agreed to that?
The prosecutor agreed that he was going to be apparently. Now, D.A. Harp says he doesn't remember it. But according to Mr. Montgomery, at most there was an agreement that he would reserve the right to make that argument.
How can there be an agreement or a deal if there aren't two sides on each on one side of the bargain?
When there's not a meeting of the minds, Your Honor, that's how.
Then there can't be an agreement.
When one party thinks there's an agreement, it says, I believe there was an agreement and there wasn't. But again, there may have been. I don't know. There may have actually been an agreement in January of 2009, but I know this from the record that was before the state court. There was no agreement prior to trial, and there was no Brady violation in this case, Your Honor.
Last question. How much was she facing on the charges that were actually filed against her?
I think there was a 20-year sentence on one of the charges. So it was a substantial possible sentence.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Campbell, one question before you start.
Yes.
Where in the same question I asked Mr. Anderson, where in the record do I find something to tell me whether or not the state produced its prosecution file to Mr. Reynolds fully, completely, without any deletions, withdrawals, withholdings, or anything else, or whether it withheld some things, like you said, some privileged documents. Where do I go in the record to find that one way or the other?
Standing here, Your Honor, I don't have a record site for you. I'm happy to supplement and try to find one. What I do have for you, though, is just a couple of things that I'd want to comment on that relate to that question. One, Your Honor just asked the state very clearly, were any documents removed. You heard, I'm not aware. You heard, the record doesn't suggest. You didn't hear one thing. You didn't hear no.
Counsel, on page 31 of your brief, it says, nor did the court, this being the Rule 32 court, address the fact that Reynolds had not been given all files related to West because the state had unilaterally removed files for privilege. There isn't a single record site after that. That generally indicates something to me.
What the state had unilaterally removed for privilege, that we know for sure, was the file, Reynolds' prosecution file, that was at the trial court below. Okay, the what was removed from Ms. West's file, because there was a clear lack of documents that should have been in there, indicated to us the files were removed there as well. And I just want to clarify another.
But it's one thing to say, or to argue to a court that the court can draw an inference from something. Whether or not that's appropriate in an AEDPA setting is another question, but it's a fair argument to make that, hey, you have facts A, B, and C. From A, B, and C, you can draw inference D and maybe inference E. But it's quite another thing to say, fact A is they withheld. And my reaction was, maybe not the same as Judge Lux, but I was looking for somewhere to be able to find some record evidence one way or another about what the state turned over or what the state didn't turn over. And now neither one of you, and I'm not blaming anybody, but neither one of you is able to tell me where in the record I can find something that gives me an answer. And that's a concern for an appellate judge.
I understand, Your Honor. What we've shown you in our briefs and what I told you before, there's clearly a letter reference, right, that was exchanged that wasn't in the file. There are numerous communications. I don't even know. So there's nothing in there from 2005 to 2007, and the state cannot tell you no. The state just get up here and with a very direct question and tell you no. I think at the least, you know, this standard that the district court was operating under here in terms of the discovery and evidentiary hearing was an abuse of discretion. Okay, it's the ADEPA standard, but for the evidentiary hearing and discovery, it's abuse of discretion. And you have, Your Honors, the significant evidence that we put below about the deal that you've characterized as unusual, struggling with it, all of the flags that exist here. We posit, Your Honor, just give Mr. Reynolds the opportunity to develop it. Let the state testify under oath that they gave over the whole file. Let us proceed with a discovery request that we ask the district court to give us the opportunity to do.
But there's a finding of the lower court and an order from the lower court which says all of it was to be turned over, and there's a finding by the ACCA that all of it was turned over. How is the district court to abuse its discretion to rely on that finding?
That finding was based on the production of Mr. Reynolds' file at the trial court.
No, that is simply not the finding of the ACCA, and that's not the case. The order from the Rule 32 court was any and all documents in the file for Ms. West, and the ACCA found that that was turned over and that that was sufficient when you argued to them that we got insufficient discovery, right?
Well, I submit, Your Honor, that was an abuse of discretion because of the evidence that we've shown through Montgomery's time records.
Yeah, but that's
and
not
just common sense.
You're mixing courts. That's the underlying state court. The federal court then takes that and says, you've said they've the district judge here in his 250-page order abuses discretion. When the district judge here said, these are these findings, they got the any and all file here. I know they've argued there's some missing stuff here, but based on my review and based on the lower court's findings, I don't think they need additional information here. They haven't established that basis. How can we say that's an abuse of discretion?
The district court didn't say, I know that they indicated the other filings. That's the problem. The state courts and district court have not addressed this issue. They have not addressed our argument Through the evidence that we have, that files are missing.
Did you make the argument to the district court?
Yes.
Then, and it ruled, right?
It didn't reference, no one has
dealt
with
this question.
There's
no requirement. We have tons of law which says there's no requirement to go over every single point raised in the party. It made a bottom line conclusion here. And I guess what I'm asking is, based on the underlying ACCA findings and based on the record here, how is that conclusion an abuse of discretion?
Because of the evidence that we put forth, that there's certainly a letter that was sent from the state, okay, and that was in Montgomery's files, and that wasn't in the file. And then there are hours and hours of conferences where there's not a single note in the record of any of those conferences before the plea, before the sentencing, during that 5 or 6 day period where Ms. West came in and cooperated and they gave her an incriminating statement. There's no notes in that file, and the state can't say no. The state was up here. He had an opportunity to say there was nothing that was removed, and he could not tell you no. That is the evidence that we have, that there were documents and that was removed. And we submit just to give Mr. Reynolds a chance to take discovery and to test his theories in the crucible of an evidentiary hearing. Again, Your Honors, if the state didn't remove any evidence, if there's nothing that else is there about the deal that we've already shown by clear and convincing evidence, let us develop that claim and let us get an evidentiary hearing before a sentence of death is executed without a single opportunity to have an evidentiary hearing in this case.
All right, Mr. Campbell, thank you very much. Mr. Anderson, thank you very much as well. All right, we're in recess on this case.